It is magnificent. At the moment of impact, the king's eyes are open, his body braced for the attack. He takes the blow perfectly, its force absorbed by a body securely armoured, moving in the right direction, moving at the right speed. His colour does not alter, his voice does not shake. "Healthy," he says. "Then I thank God for his favour to us, as I thank you, my lords, for this comfortable intelligence." He thinks Henry has been rehearsing. I suppose we all have. The king walks away towards his own rooms, says over his shoulder, "Call her Elizabeth. Cancel the jousts." A bleat from a Boleyn. "The other ceremonies as planned?" No reply. Cranmer says all as planned till we hear different. "I am to stand godfather to the princess," he falters. He can hardly believe it. For himself, he ordered a daughter, and he got a daughter. His eyes follow Henry's retreating back.
"He did not ask after the queen. He did not ask how she does."
"It hardly matters, does it?" Edward Seymour, saying brutally what everyone is thinking. Then Henry, on his long, solitary walk, stops, turns back. "My Lord Archbishop, Cromwell, but you only." In Henry's closet, "How do you imagine this?" Some would smile. He does not. The king drops into a chair. The urge arises to put a hand on his shoulder, as one does for any inconsolable being. He resists it, simply folds his fingers, protectively, into the fist which holds the king's heart. "One day we will make a great marriage for her." "Poor Scrap. Her own mother will wish her away."
"Your Majesty is young enough," Cranmer says. "The Queen is strong and her family are fertile. You can get another child soon, and perhaps God intends some peculiar blessing by this princess."
"My dear friend, I am sure you are right." Henry sounds dubious, but he looks around to take strength from his surroundings, as if God might have left some friendly message written on the wall. Though there is only precedent for the hostile kind. He takes a breath, and stands up and shakes out his sleeves. He smiles, and one can catch in flight, as if it were a bird with a strong beating heart, the act of will that transforms a desolate wretch into the beacon of his nation. He whispers to Cranmer later, "It was like watching Lazarus get up." Soon, Henry is striding about the palace at Greenwich, putting the celebrations underway. "We are young enough," he says, "and next time it will be a boy. One day we will make a great marriage for her. Believe me, God intends some peculiar blessing by this princess." Boleyn faces Brighton. It's Sunday, 4 p.m. He goes and laughs a bit at the clerks who have "Prince" written on their proclamations, and who now have to squeeze extra letters in. Then he goes back to working out the expenses for the new princess's household. He has advised that Gertrude, Lady Exeter, be among the child's godparents. Why should only the maid have a vision of her? It'll do her good to be seen by the whole court, smiling a forced smile and holding Anne's baby at the font. The maid herself, brought to London, is kept in a private house, where the beds are soft and the voices around her, the voices of Cromwell women, hardly disturb her prayers. Where the key is turned in the oiled lock with a click as small as the snap of a bird's bone. "Does she eat?" he asks Mercy, and she says, "She eats as heartily as you." "Well, no, Thomas, perhaps not quite so heartily as you. I wonder what happened to her project of living on the communion host."
"They can't see her dining now, can they? Those priests and monks who set her on this course?"
Away from their scrutiny, the nun has started to act like an ordinary woman, acknowledging the simple claims of her body, like anyone who wants to live. But it may be too late. He likes it that Mercy doesn't say, "Ah, the poor harmless soul." That she is not harmless by nature is clear,
when they have her over to Lambeth Palace to question her. You would think Lord Chancellor Audley, his chain of office hung about his splendid person, would be enough to subdue any country girl. Throw in the Archbishop of Canterbury, and you would imagine a young nun might feel some awe. Not a bit of it. The maid treats Cranmer with condescension, as if he were a novice in the religious life. When he challenges her on any point and says,
"How did you know that?"
she smiles pityingly and says,
"An angel told me."
Audley brings Richard Rich with him to their second session, to take notes for them, and put any points that occur to him. He is Sir Richard now, knighted and promoted to Solicitor General. In his student days he was known for a sharp, slanderous tongue, for irreverence to his seniors, for drinking and gaming for high stakes. But who would hold up his head if people judged us by what we were like at 20? Rich turns out to have a talent for drafting legislation, which is second only to his own. His features, beneath his soft, fair hair, are pinched with concentration. The boys call him Sir Purse. You'd never think, to see him precisely laying out his papers, that he was once the great disgrace of the Inner Temple. He says so in an undertone, teasing him, while they wait for the girl to be brought in. "Well, Master Cromwell," Rich says, "what about you and that abbess in Halifax?" He knows better than to deny it, or any of those stories the Cardinal told about him. "Oh, that," he says. "It was nothing. They expect it in Yorkshire." He is afraid the girl may have caught the tail end of the exchange, because today, as she takes the chair they have placed for her, she gives him a particularly hard stare. She arranges her skirts, folds her arms, and waits for them to entertain her. His niece, Alice Wellyfed, sits on a stool by the door, just there in case of fainting or other upset. Though a glance at the maid tells you, she's no more likely to faint than Audley is. "Shall I," Rich says, "start?"
"Oh, why not?" Audley says. "You are young and hearty."
"These prophecies of yours, you are always changing the timing of the disaster you foresee. But I understood you said that the king would not reign 1 month after he married Lady Anne. Well, the months have passed, Lady Anne is crowned queen, and has given the king a fine daughter. So what do you say now?"
"I say in the eyes of the world he seems to be king. But in the eyes of God," she shrugs, "not any more. He is no more the real king than he," she nods towards Cranmer, "is really archbishop."
Rich is not to be sidetracked. "So, it would be justified to raise rebellion against him, to depose him, to assassinate him, to put another in his place?"
"Well, what do you think?"
"And among the claimants, your choice has fallen on the Courtenay family, not the Poles. Henry, Marquis of Exeter, not Henry, Lord Montague." "Or," he says sympathetically, "do you get them mixed up?"
"Of course not," she flashes. "I have met both those gentlemen."
Rich makes a note. Audley says,
"Now, Courtenay, that is Lord Exeter, descends from a daughter of King Edward. Lord Montague descends from King Edward's brother, the Duke of Clarence. How do you weigh their claims? Because if we are talking of true kings and false kings, some say Edward was a bastard his mother got by an archer. I wonder if you can cast any light."
"Why would she?" Rich says. Audley rolls his eyes.
"Because she talks to the saints on high. They'd know."
He looks at Rich, and it is as if he can read his thoughts. Niccolo's book says, "The wise prince exterminates the envious, and if I, Rich, were king, those claimants and their families would be dead." The girl is braced for the next question. How is it she has seen two queens in her vision?
"I suppose it will sort itself out," he says, "in the fighting. It's good to have a few kings and queens in reserve, if you're going to start a war in a country."
"It is not necessary to have a war," the nun says.
"Oh?" Sir Purse sits up. This is new.
God is sending a plague on England instead. Henry will be dead in 6 months. So will she, Thomas Boleyn's daughter.
And me?
You too.
And all in this room, except you, of course. All including Alice Wellyfed, who never did you harm.
All the women of your house are heretics, and the plague will rot them body and soul.
And what about the Princess Elizabeth?
She turns in her seat to aim her words at Cranmer.
They say when you christened her, you warmed the water to spare her a shock. You should have poured it boiling.
Oh, Christ in heaven, Rich says. He throws his pen down. He's a tender young father with a daughter in the cradle. He drops a consoling hand on his, the Solicitor General's. You would think Alice would need consoling, but when the maid condemned her to death, he had looked down the room at his niece to note that her face was the perfect picture of derision. He says to Rich,
"She didn't think it up herself, the boiling water. It is a thing they're saying on the streets."
Cranmer huddles into himself. The maid has bruised him. She has scored a point. He, Cromwell says,
"I saw the princess yesterday. She is thriving in spite of her ill wishes."
His voice suggests calm. "We must get the Archbishop back in the saddle." He turns to the maid.
"Tell me, did you locate the Cardinal?"
"What?"
Audley says.
"Dame Elizabeth said she would look out for my old master on one of her excursions to heaven, hell, and purgatory, and I offered to pay her travelling expenses on the occasion. I gave her people a down payment. I hope we see some progress."
"Wolsey would have had another 15 years of life," the girl says.
He nods. He has said the same himself.
"But then God cut him off as an example. I have seen devils disputing for his soul."
"You know the result?" he asks.
"There is no result. I searched for him all over. I thought God had extinguished him. Then one night I saw him."
A long, tactical hesitation.
"I saw his soul seated among the unborn."
There is a silence. Cranmer shrinks in his seat. Rich gently nibbles the end of his pen. Audley twists a button on his sleeve, round and round till the thread tightens.
"If you like, I can pray for him," the maid says. "God usually answers my requests."
"Formerly, when you had your advisers about you, Father Bocking and Father Gold and Father Risby and the rest, you would start bargaining at this point. I would propose a further sum for your goodwill, and your spiritual directors would drive it up."
"Wait,"
Cranmer lays a hand over his ribcage.
"Can we go back, Lord Chancellor?"
"We can go in any direction you choose, my Lord Archbishop. 3 times round the mulberry bush."
"You see devils?"
She nods.
"They appear how?"
"Birds."
"A relief,"
Audley says dryly.
"No, sir. Lucifer stinks. His claws are deformed. He comes as a cockerel smeared in blood and shit."
He looks up at Alice. He is ready to send her out. He thinks, what has been done to this woman?
Cranmer says, "That must be disagreeable for you. But it is a characteristic of devils, I understand, to show themselves in more than one way."
"Yes. They do it to deceive you. He comes as a young man."
"Indeed."
"Once he brought a woman to my cell at night."
She pauses.
"Pouring her,"
Rich says.
"He is known to have no shame."
"No more than you."
"And what then, Dame Elizabeth, after the pouring?"
"Pulled up her skirts."
"And she didn't resist," Rich says.
"You surprise me."
Audley says,
"Prince Lucifer, I don't doubt he has a way with him."
"Before my eyes, he had to do with her on my bed."
Rich makes a note.
"This woman, did you know her?"
No answer.
and the devil did not try the same with you. You can speak freely. It will not be held against you.
He came to sweet-talk me, swaggering in his blue silk coat. It's the best he has, and new hose with diamonds down his legs.
Diamonds down his legs, he says. Now that must have been a temptation. She shakes her head. But you are a fine young woman, good enough for any man, I'd say. She looks up, a flicker of a smile.
I am not for Master Lucifer.
What did he say when you refused him?
He asked me to marry him.
Audley puts his head in his hands.
I said I was vowed to chastity.
Was he not angry when you would not consent?
Oh, yes, he spat in my face.
I would expect no better of him, Rich says.
I wiped his spit off with a napkin. It's black. It has the stench of hell.
What is that like?
Like something rotting.
Where is it now, the napkin? I suppose you didn't send it to the laundry.
Dom Edward has it.
Does he show it to people for money?
For offerings.
For money. Cranmer takes his face from his hands.
Shall we pause?
A quarter hour, Rich says. Audley says, I told you he was young and hearty.
Well, perhaps we will meet tomorrow, Cranmer says. I need to pray, and a quarter of an hour will not do it.
But tomorrow is Sunday, the nun says. There was a man who went out hunting on a Sunday, and he fell down a bottomless pit into hell. Imagine that.
How is it bottomless? Rich asks. If hell was there to receive him. I wish I were going hunting, Audley says. Christ knows I'd take a chance on it. Alice rises from her stool and signals for her escort. The maid gets to her feet. She's smiling broadly. She has made the Archbishop flinch, and himself grow cold, and the Solicitor General all but weep with her talk of scalded babies. She thinks she is winning, but she's losing, losing, losing all the time. Alice puts a gentle hand on her arm, but the maid shakes it off. Outside, Richard Rich says, "We should burn her." Cranmer says,
"Much as we may dislike her talk of the late Cardinal appearing to her, the devil's in her bedchamber, she speaks in this way because she has been taught to ape the claims of certain nuns who have gone before her, nuns whom Rome is pleased to recognize as saints. I cannot convict them of heresy, retrospectively, nor have I evidence to try her for heresy."
"Burn for treason," I meant. It is the woman's penalty, where a man is half-hanged and castrated, then slowly gutted by the executioner. He says, "There is no overt action. She has only expressed an intent." "Intent to raise rebellion, to depose the king. Should that not be treason? Words have been construed as treasons. There are precedents, you know them." "I should be astonished," Audley says, "if they have escaped Cromwell's attention." It is as if they can smell the devil's spit. They are almost jostling each other to get into the air, which is mild, damp. A faint scent of leaves, a green-gold rustling light. He can see that in the years ahead treason will take new and various forms. When the last treason act was made, no one could circulate their words in a printed book or bill, because printed books were not thought of. He feels a moment of jealousy towards the dead, to those who served kings in slower times than these. Nowadays, the products of some bought or poisoned brain can be disseminated through Europe in a month. "I think new laws are needed," Rich says. "I have it in hand. And I think this woman is too leniently kept. We are too soft. We are just playing with her." Cranmer walks away, shoulders stooped, his trailing habit brushing up the leaves. Audley turns to him, bright and resolute, a man keen to change the subject. "So, the princess, you say she was well?" The princess, unswaddled, had been placed on cushions at Anne's feet.
an ugly, purple, grizzling knot of womankind, with an upstanding ruff of pale hair, and a habit of kicking up her gown, as if to display her most unfortunate feature. It seems stories have been put about that Anne's child was born with teeth, has six fingers on each hand, and is furred all over like a monkey. So her father has shown her off naked to the ambassadors, and her mother is keeping her on display in the hope of countering the rumours. The king has chosen Hatfield for her seat, and Anne says, "It seems to me waste might be saved, and the proper order of things asserted, if Spanish Mary's household were broken up, and she were to become a member of the household of the Princess Elizabeth, my daughter." In the capacity of... The child is quiet. Only, he notes, because she has crammed a fist into her maw and is cannibalizing herself. "In the capacity of my daughter's servant, what else should she be? There can be no pretense at equality. Mary is a bastard." The brief respite is over. The princess sets up a screech that would bring out the dead. Anne's glance slides away sideways, and a sideways grin of infatuation takes over her whole face, and she leans down towards her daughter. But at once women swoop, flapping and bustling. The screaming creature is plucked up, wrapped up, swept away, and the queen's eyes follow pitifully as the fruit of her womb exits in procession. He says gently, "I think she was hungry." Saturday evening. Supper at Austin Fry's for Stephen Vaughan, so often in transit, William Butts, Hans, Kratzer, Call Me Risley. Conversation is in various tongues, and Rafe Sadler translates adroitly, smoothly, his head turning from side to side. High topics and low, statecraft and gossip. Zwingli's theology, Cranmer's wife. About the latter, it has not been possible to suppress the talk at the steelyard and in the city. Vaughan says, "Can Henry know and not know?" "That is perfectly possible. He is a prince of very large capacities." "Larger by the day," Risley says, laughing. Dr. Butt says, "He is one of those men who must be active, and recently his leg is troubling him, that old injury. But think, is it likely that a man who has not spared himself on the hunting field and in the tilt yard should not get some injury by the time he is the king's age? He's 43 this year, you know, and I shall be glad, Kratzer, to have your view on what the planets suggest, for the later years of a man whose chart is so dominated by air and fire. By the by, did I not always warn of his moon in Aries, rash and hasty planet, in the house of marriage?" He says, impatient, "We heard very little about the Aries moon when he was settled with Catherine for 20 years. It is not the stars that make us, Dr. Butts. It is circumstance and necessita, the choices we make under pressure. Our virtues make us, but virtues are not enough. We must deploy our vices at times. Or don't you agree?" He beckons to Christophe to fill their glasses. They talk about the Mint, where Vaughan is to have a position, about Calais, where Honor Lyle seems more busy in affairs than her husband the governor. He thinks about Guido Camillo in Paris, pacing and fretting between the wooden walls of his memory machine, while knowledge grows unseen and of itself in its cavities and concealed inner spaces. He thinks of the Holy Maid, by now established as not holy and not a maid. No doubt at this moment sitting down to supper with his nieces. He thinks of his fellow interrogators, Cranmer on his knees in prayer, Sir Perse frowning over the day's transcripts. Audley, what will the Lord Chancellor be doing? Polishing his chain of office, he decides. He thinks of saying to Vaughan, below the conversation, "Was there not a girl in your house called Yenica? What happened to her?" But Risley breaks in on his train of thought. "When shall we see my master's portrait? You have been at work on it a while, Hans. It is time it came home. We are keen to see what you have made of him."
"He is still busy with the French envoys," Kratzer says. "De Danteville wants to take his picture home with him when he gets his recall."
There is some laughter at the expense of the French ambassador, always doing his packing and having to undo it again, as his master commands him to stay where he is.
"Anyway, I hope he does not take it too quick," Hans says, "because I mean to show it and get commissions off it. I want the king to see it. Indeed, I want to paint the king. Do you think I can?"
"I will ask him," he says easily. "Let me choose the time." He looks down the table to see Vaughan glow with pride like Jupiter on a painted ceiling. After they get up from the table, his guests eat ginger comfits and candied fruits, and Kratzer makes some drawings. He draws the sun and the planets moving in their orbits according to the plan he has heard of from Father Copernicus. He shows how the world is turning on its axis, and nobody in the room denies it. Under your feet, you can feel the tug and heft of it, the rocks groaning to tear away from their beds, the oceans tilting and slapping at their shores, the giddy lurch of alpine passes, the forests of Germany ripping at their roots to be free. The world is not what it was when he and Vaughan were young. It is not what it was even in the Cardinal's day. The company has left when his niece Alice comes in, past his watchman, wrapped up in a cloak. She is escorted by Thomas Rotherham, one of his wards who lives in the house.
"Never fear, sir," she says. "Joe is sitting up with Dame Elizabeth, and nothing gets by Joe."
Does it not? That child perpetually in tears over her spoiled sewing. That grubby little girl sometimes found rolling under a table with a wet dog, or chasing a peddler down the street.
"I would like to talk to you," Alice says, "if you have time for me."
"Of course," he says, taking her arm, folding her hand in his. Thomas Rotherham turns pale, which puzzles him, and slides away. Alice sits down in his office. She yawns.
"Excuse me, but she is hard work and the hours are long."
She tucks a strand of hair into her hood.
"She is ready to break," she says. "She is brave to your face, but she cries at night because she knows she is a fraud. And even while she is crying, she peeps under her eyelids to see what effect she's making."
"I want it over with now," he says, "for all the trouble she has caused. We do not find ourselves an edifying spectacle, three or four of us learned in the law and the scriptures, convening day after day to try to trip one chit of a girl."
"Why did you not bring her in before?"
"I didn't want her to shut the prophecy shop. I wanted to see who would come to her whistle. And Lady Exeter has, and Bishop Fisher, and a score of monks and foolish priests whose names I know, and 100 perhaps whose names I don't know yet."
"And will the king kill them all?"
"Very few, I hope."
"You incline him to mercy?"
"I incline him to patience."
"What will happen to her, Dame Eliza?"
"We will frame charges."
"She will not go in a dungeon."
"No. I shall move the king to treat her with consideration. He is always, he is usually, respectful of any person in the religious life." "But, Alice," he sees that she is dissolving into tears, "I think this has all been too much for you."
"No, not at all. We are soldiers in your army."
"She's not been frightening you, talking about the devil's wicked offers?"
"No. It's Thomas Rotherham's office. He wants to marry me."
"So that's what's wrong with him." He's amused. "Could he not ask himself?"
"He thought he would look at him in that way you have, as if you were weighing him."
"Like a clipped coin." "Alice, he owns a fat slice of Bedfordshire, and his manners prosper very nicely since I have been looking after them. And if you like each other, how could I object? You are a clever girl, Alice. Your mother," he says softly, "and your father, they would be very pleased with you, if they were able to see." This is why Alice is crying. She must ask her uncle's permission because this last year has left her orphaned. The day his sister Bet died, he was up country with the king. Henry was receiving no messages from London for fear of contagion, so she was dead and buried before he knew she was ill. When the news crept through at last, the king spoke to him with tenderness
a hand on his arm. He spoke of his own sister, the silver-haired lady like a princess in a book, removed from this life to gardens of paradise he had claimed, reserved for royal dead.